This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, eye-opening study out of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Obesity rates have risen significantly for American women. The first time since these statistics have been measured, 40% of American women have been designated as obese. That's a startling number.
It is, Mark. And according to the study, women have now surpassed men in obesity rates, 40% for women, 35% for men. This does not bode well for the future health of this population as it ages, not to mention the impact on the healthcare industry.
The JAMA survey also revealed another alarming trend, Margaret. While obesity rates are actually dropping for the nation's preschoolers to under 10%, the nation's teens are seeing an uptick in obesity. In the past 25 years, the number of teens who qualify as obese has gone from 1 in 10 to 1 in 5, and we know that's only setting up these millions of teens for a whole host of chronic diseases later on, and sadly, sooner than later.
Well, this is longitudinal data, Mark. The study goes back to the 1960s when the first signs of the obesity epidemic were starting to emerge, though I don't think we paid so much attention then. It's called the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. You can access the information by going to their website, cdc.gov/NCHS. Really just need to understand the trajectory of this epidemic, Mark, if we're going to really address the problem.
Well, our guest today has crafted a very interesting approach to the obesity problem, Margaret. Dr. Robert Czar is a Washington, D.C.-based pediatrician who launched the ParkRx program, inspiring clinicians to prescribe time in nature for his patients.
Well, Dr. Czar has been growing this ParkRx program around the country and even the world and seeing some great success within his own population of patients as well. So we're looking forward to that, Mark. And of course, Lori Robertson will be stopping by, the managing editor of FactCheck.org, always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain.
But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter because we'd love to hear from you. Now we'll get to our interview with Dr. Czar in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. In the wake of the latest mass shooting in Orlando, which left 50 people dead and more than 50 wounded, the Senate took up four measures that would have made gun laws more restrictive. All four measures failed to pass the Republican majority. The Democratic bill would have expanded the use of background checks beyond only federally licensed dealers to include private gun sellers and all sales online. A competing measure from Republican Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa was also rejected. It would have encouraged states to submit relevant mental health records to the nation's background check system. Meanwhile, in the immediate aftermath of the Orlando shootings, thousands of residents turned up to donate blood. While the FDA has lifted a ban on gay men donating blood entirely, they still can't be donors if they've had sex within the past 6 months. Senators Elizabeth Warren and Tammy Baldwin issued a terse message to the president as well as the FDA that such policies are discriminatory and need to be changed. For the coming of the Zika virus, a bit of progress out of the lab. U.S. officials have given the green light for an experimental vaccine for Zika due to begin human testing in coming weeks. Inovio Pharmaceuticals has received clearance from the FDA to begin these early stage safety tests of a DNA-based vaccine against the mosquito-borne virus. Researchers at the National Institutes of Health expect to begin testing their own DNA-based Zika vaccine by early fall. Meanwhile, the impact of Zika continues to spread, and Zika virus has already affected 60 countries on four continents. And a major outbreak on the Atlantic Ocean island nation of Cape Verde suggests the disease is now poised to enter continental Africa. Zika has already become epidemic in Latin America and the Caribbean. Hospitals are seeing a reduction in the numbers of patients they treat who are uninsured, at least in the states that expanded Medicaid. That, according to a study done at the University of Michigan. For the new study, researchers analyzed data on young adults discharged from 130 Michigan hospitals before and after Medicaid became more broadly available in 2014. About 6% of young adults discharged at these hospitals before the Medicaid expansion were uninsured, compared to about 2% during the months after 2014. So fewer uninsured hospital patients, more hospital bills, getting paid. And on the heels of Philadelphia passing the nation's first tax on sugary beverages comes some promising overall dietary news. Americans are drinking less soda and sugary drinks. Study done by researchers at Tufts showed Americans are drinking less soda and increasing consumption of whole grains and nuts. While these are marked improvements, a study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association showed over the past decade many people still consumed too much sugar and processed food and not enough whole fruits and vegetables. Those consuming a poor diet dropped from 56% down to 46% over a decade. But there were disparities as well. Those who were more affluent and white had much higher consumption of whole fruits and vegetables and less sugar consumed compared to minorities and those living closer to the poverty line. I'm Ariane O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Robert Czar, board-certified pediatrician at Unity Healthcare in Washington, D.C. He's founder of the D.C. Park RX program and is Park RX advisor to the National Park Service, a national community health initiative to prescribe activity in nature for patients to achieve optimal health. Dr. Czar is the past president of the D.C. chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. He's the assistant clinical professor at the Children's National Medical Center and George Washington University. Dr. Czar earned his medical degree at Baylor College of Medicine, his master's of public health from the University of Texas School of Public Health, and completed his pediatric residency at Texas Children's Hospital in Houston. Dr. Czar, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you, Mark and Margaret. Thank you for having me today.
Yeah, and you're a pediatrician serving a patient population, one of the toughest regions in the country, and you've seen firsthand the effects of poverty and the health of children and the worrisome growth of chronic illness in America. And I'm wondering if you could talk to our listeners a little bit about their growing chronic disease burden and why this trend is so alarming.
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's also, I think, even more interesting that you're asking a pediatrician about chronic disease. Certainly when I was in training, there was little to no mention of the burden of chronic disease in children. I think it was already well established in the adult population. But what we've seen in the last 20 years has been a dramatic increase in chronic disease in children as well. And I just for the, you know, the audience here, just to be clear that what is chronic disease, these are things that we all know about. These are, you know, things like high blood pressure and diabetes, pre-diabetes, being overweight or obese, which is an independent risk factor to develop other kinds of chronic disease, as well as mental health, serious mental health illnesses, things like depression and anxiety, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder in both children and adults. So there's this sort of large basket of illness and is ultimately causing premature death. And on top of all of that, we're also spending 86 cents on the dollar managing chronic disease. These are healthcare dollars that we're spending on actual care. So really, we've shifted so much in the last 50 years from a lot of acute management to a lot of chronic care management, both in children and adults. So that's quite fatiguing, actually, for providers of healthcare to sort of have to process this every day when patients and families come in with really burdensome issues that, you know, I think can be somewhat addressed with a different perspective, and that is really thinking about this from a wellness perspective and a prevention perspective.
Well, Dr. Czar, let's talk about the logistics of launching a program like Prescription for Parks or Park RX and creating an infrastructure for it. Had to be a daunting task. You're doing this in the midst of a very busy practice as a pediatrician in a community health center. But you realized that there were hundreds of parks in Washington, D.C., in the surrounding area, and you figured out a way to map them out so that your patients could easily access a park that was most suitable for their needs and their location. Tell us about how you partnered with a local park service to actually create this service that not only you could utilize, but that other clinicians could utilize, as well as your patients and their families.
So, you know, what I've come to realize is that this idea of prescribing a park actually resonates quite easily with providers of healthcare, with the public at large, and with the land and water management agencies, because it just makes sense. I mean, we all intuitively know that it's better for us at some level, whether it's a mental health issue, just a wellness issue, or even a physical health issue, to be more outsized, especially in natural settings. So when I started this project almost 6 years ago, I was thinking it might be relatively easy for me just to go to a website and find all of the parks, all of the green space in my city, and I assumed for every other city, and just, you know, make that available to people so they can know where it is. And in fact, it really wasn't that simple. And so I had to work with local agencies, your local Department of Park and Rec, Department of Health, with a number of different local agencies, as well as some regional and national organizations who've really helped along the way, from the National Park Service to the National Rec and Park Association. But at the end of the day, you know, there's a handful of agencies wherever anybody lives, especially in an urban area. So obviously that was a no-brainer for me, just to reach out to those local agencies. And in my case in D.C., because most of the green land is actually managed and owned by the federal government, the National Park Service, reach out to them and ask them if they want to partner with us. And what I found out was is that the Park Service was a little bit ahead of the medical and public health community with respect to prescribing parks, because they have already a program called Healthy Parks, Healthy People, within which Park Prescription or ParkRx falls. And they were actually very excited that here was a doctor, and now there's many of us actually around the country who are reaching out to them and working with them and partnering with them to figure out ways in which we can take all of this data and put it into a format that is easy to use and explain it to the medical and public health communities that's easy for them to understand and relevant to their work, and incorporate that into the daily routines of what doctors, nurses, social workers, therapists do anyway, every day. So we really think of this as a tool that we can use every day, especially when we're seeing patients who are suffering from chronic disease or who are at high risk of chronic disease, even somebody who's not, who just needs to be outside more. And we've placed that inside of our electronic health record. And, you know, right now we're in the midst of developing a national database. So, you know, within a few years, I can imagine taking a tool that we've developed here in D.C. and, you know, modeling a national park database after what we've done here and making it available to everybody. You know, the truth is that, you know, we'll have about 70% of our world's population living in an urban area by 2030, which is only 14 years away. So this issue of urban parks and access to urban parks is becoming increasingly more important and relevant to public health.
We're speaking today with Dr. Robert Czar, board-certified pediatrician at Unity Healthcare in Washington, D.C. He's founder of the D.C. Park RX and the nationwide Park RX program in partnership with the National Park Service. Park RX is a national community health initiative to prescribe activity in nature for patients to achieve optimal health. You know, Dr. Czar, I was thinking as you were talking about making relevant to providers the work that you're doing, that you're bound to find folks who wanted to talk about the science that supports the work you're doing. And there is so much empirical evidence about the powerful impact of health just being in nature. And it's been said that if this came into a bottle, it probably would be considered a miracle drug. So could you share with the listeners some of the empirical data that you have? What are the proven health benefits?
I'm glad that you mentioned just spending time in parks. You know, I think we're moving away from that in some ways and trying to, you know, make our recommendations a little more palatable to everyone. And I say that now with, you know, myself even having nursing a knee injury. It's not easy for me to walk right now. And the irony is that, you know, I need nature now more than ever, because it's really hard on someone's mental health when they can't continue their daily routine the way they used to do it. So there is a significant body of scientific literature now that's looking at a wide variety of health benefits. You know, it ranges from physical health, mental health. We know from a number of studies that your overall mortality even goes down if you just live closer to a green space. The presumption is that the closer you live to a green space, the more likely you are to use it. We have groups of Japanese who are being taken in buses going into the forest and having these forest bathing trips, they call them. Mm. And they've measured cortisol levels, and they've actually monitored those and found they actually go down when people spend time in a forested area walking. We also know that blood pressure can be decreased by spending time in outdoor, green outdoor settings. You know, we know that noise, different kinds of noise affect you. And interestingly enough, you know, we know that now from some scientific studies that, you know, the noise of an urban scape, just the traffic in general, actually makes us anxious. We know that, both anecdotally and with data now. But the obverse is true for somebody who's walking in a green setting where you may hear the rustling of the leaves, you may hear the sound of the birds. And those kinds of noise actually have a calming effect, and not just a calming effect, but actually restore our attention. So it's really important for us to be able to restore that ability for us to pay attention and to listen. We also have some studies that have looked even at type 2 diabetes, and we know that living near a green space and having the time to spend in parks lowers your risk of developing type 2 diabetes. I think it's pretty clear that to most of us that we just feel better. Mm-hmm. And that's enough for me, and that's enough for my patients, just to know that, you know, they can actually bring some more happiness into their life, which is significant and which actually is relevant and does matter.
Well, Dr. Czar, as frontline clinicians, there's always the challenge with preventive services of time, and also the science and the art of motivating people to undertake behavioral change, even if it's a very positive change. Tell us how you've been able to encourage your patients to be willing to fill those prescriptions for outdoor time. And what's your experience been of encouraging providers to adopt this as an approach that has real benefits for their patients, but to fit it into those clinical encounters where they are so pressed for time?
Yeah. It's a great question, Margaret. And, you know, it's one that I get asked often. Do my patients and, you know, my colleagues, do they roll their eyes, you know, when we suggest they, you know, spend a little bit more time outside? When we actually write a prescription for them to play in a park or be in a park. And, you know, the quick answer is no. I think a lot of that has to do with the trusting relationship between healers and patients. I think that is essentially what this boils down to is, you know, do you trust your social worker, your therapist, your doctor to give you advice like this? And through that trusting relationship, which is a very ancient one, therein lies the opportunities to listen, to know your patient, to make some quick decisions while you're there in the office as to whether it's even appropriate to make a recommendation for them in terms of their readiness, their mental readiness to even think about this. So sometimes it just might involve a quick conversation about, you know, how they spend their day. You know, what's their routine like? And if you're seeing somebody for chronic disease issues, you're seeing them pretty frequently anyway. You're seeing them between every 1 and 3 months. So there's plenty of opportunities to bring this up. But asking your patient, you know, what their routine is like and then listening to them, and often that alone is part of the therapy. And you can learn so much about, you know, how they spend their day. And they, in turn, also learn how they spend their day because they're actually verbalized. And it's in that moment, oftentimes, you know, I'll say, well, what do you think about that? You know, do you think that you need to tweak your schedule just a little bit? You know, let's talk about, you know, times or places, opportunities during your day that we might be able to get you outside if you're ready for that kind of advice. Then there's the art of medicine in terms of, you know, figuring out what that advice will really end up being. And I'll just ask them very, you know, open-ended questions. And as we move along, they'll become more specific. And I'll ask them, you know, what are you ready to commit to right now? And I can help you find ways to do it. I can help you find places to do it. I can, you know, write this down for you. I can sort of a contract, so to speak, between my patient and me or my family and me. And that allows us sort of a launching point. And then they come back and we talk about this. So, you know, it's really no different than anything else we do in medicine and public health. Regardless of what the issue is, I think it's that trusting relationship that takes us far in terms of changing the way in which we provide health and the way in which we help ourselves.
Huh. It's a simple message with profound impact. And thinking about profound things, sort of Washington, D.C., not only our nation's capital, but you've got two great leaders, you with the ParkRx program and our First Lady, Michelle Obama, who came out with her Let's Move program, championing better diet and exercise. You know, at the same time, we're seeing this sort of explosion in the fitness wearable industry, certainly focused in on all of us, but the younger generation seems to have more uptake with this. Insurance companies are coming by and providing some incentives. And I'm just wondering, how do you see technologies morphing over to the work that you're doing with the national programs, sort of aimed at the same goal of getting people to be engaged in more physical activity and, as you describe it, getting more vitamin N? Talk to us a little bit about where you see this evolving over the next decade.
That's a good point. So Richard Louv, I'm glad you alluded to vitamin N. Richard Louv's new book, he's author of Last Child in the Woods, which actually was a great inspiration for me to do something about this. And I heard him speak about 6 years ago in San Francisco. This question of exercise is a very important one in technology. Richard Louv has said before that, I think it's a really good sort of framework to put this into, which is that, the more technology we have in our life, the more nature we need to balance it out. And that, I think, is a good way to think about technology, because, technology isn't bad, and it's not necessarily a always a balancing game, although it is, I just put it that way to you, that, the more of one, the more of the other you need. But I think there's other ways to think about the role of technology. And I've actually really embraced technology with this. I mean, obviously, I'm, helping to create, park databases around the country and linking them to electronic health records so that we can use this tool real time with our patients and prescribe parks. But the question, as you've alluded to, is quite larger than that. In that, how do we get our hands around, or minds and hands around, technology so that it doesn't run our schedule. A word that I often use is judicious. There's a judicious amount of technology that is sort of the right amount, the right dose of technology, and also how you use it. So, there's no going back. I mean, we've got our younger population is, much more facile with mobile devices and all of the, technological advances than probably we are on this call. And I think we need to embrace that. I mean, that's sort of their world. I mean, they have been born into a world of vast amount of technology and mobile devices now. And that's one of the things that we're trying to do here in D.C. is, in fact, is create this access to the green world through mobile devices. So we're actually developing an app that'll probably come out sometime end of this year, early next year, where not only can we do this in the office and on a website, and even already now we can find parks, on mobile devices through mobile friendly websites, but to really make it much more user friendly for everyone. And even tying that back into your health providers too. So, why is it that it's somewhat complicated now to often get a message back to your health provider? We have these things called patient portals now, and many patients know what I'm talking about. And it's a way for patients to communicate with their health providers, in that interim period between one visit and the next. And I think that there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to do that as well with a park prescription. I would like to know, what the experience was like for my patients after I prescribed a particular park and after they agreed to go there several times a week and do some set activity. So I should be able to know what's going on if they want to tell me in that interim. And so to help tweak that experience to make sure it's really optimal for them during the time that I'm not seeing them. So I think there's many ways to think about technology and how we can use it to our good and not to our detriment. But I think still the advice is sage advice from, mm-hmm. from Richard Louv that we do need to be aware of how much time. At the end of the day, it definitely is important to be aware of how much time we're spending in front of a screen and how little time we're spending out in nature. So I hope I'm answering that question to your satisfaction. It's actually not an easy one to answer, but it's one I think we all have to grapple with.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Robert Czar, pediatrician at Unity Healthcare, a community health center in Washington, D.C., and the founder of DC Park RX and the nationwide Park RX program in partnership with the National Park Service. You can learn more about his work by going to dcparksrx.org or parkrx.org and follow him on Twitter at Doc Czar. Dr. Czar, thank you so much for the work that you do and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you, Margaret and Mark.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Laurie Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Laurie, what have you got for us this week?
Donald Trump said hairspray's not like it used to be because chemicals in it that affect the ozone layer have been banned. Many countries began phasing out the ozone-depleting substances in hairspray in the late 1980s, but these regulations wouldn't affect the quality of hairspray. Trump also said using hairspray in his apartment, which he said was all sealed, would prevent any ozone-depleting substances from escaping into the environment. But these chemicals would still make their way out, experts told us. Trump has been making false claims about hairspray in the ozone layer for at least 5 years, and most recently made these statements at a rally in West Virginia. Hairspray is made up of chemicals that make hair stiff and a propellant. Before the signing of the Montreal Protocol in 1987, hairspray and other aerosols used chlorofluorocarbons as propellants. CFCs are potent ozone-depleting substances. A weakened ozone layer leads to an increase in ultraviolet radiation, which then brings about higher rates of skin cancer, cataracts, and immune system problems in human populations. The gravity of the issue prompted countries to phase out CFCs. Hairspray now uses HFCs, or hydrofluorocarbons, and the ozone layer is recovering. But these regulations have nothing to do with the stiffening agent in the spray, only the propellant that propels the stiffening agent out of the can. As for Trump's sealed apartment, we interviewed both a chemist and a physicist with the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration. They told us it makes no difference if you spray chemicals inside or outside. They will eventually make it outside, moving through the lower atmosphere over months before being transported up to the stratosphere. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Laurie Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Laurie Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Food labeling could be going one step further than simple calorie counts in the future. Public health researchers at the University of North Carolina have some pep in their step for another approach to getting consumers' attention when pondering those food and beverage choices. There's growing interest in a new approach to displaying calorie counts next to menu items. Instead, show the amount of exercise that would be required to burn off those calories consumed from drinking, say, a 20-ounce cola. They developed an icon symbolizing a person walking and how far that person would have to walk to erase the calories they were just about to consume. They conducted a randomized study to determine what, if any, effect the measure would have on consumer choices.
And we showed them basically a full menu with all items. And so one group was randomized to no information except the food items. Another one was a menu of pretty much every item, exact same way, and it had the calories. And then a third option had calories plus minutes to walk with our little figure, and it had, you know, for example, 91 minutes. And then finally a fourth menu that showed the same exact thing with the same exact figure with miles to walk, so it might say 5.1 miles.
Dr. Anthony Vieira, professor at the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill School of Public Health, he said the study showed quite clearly that when consumers saw that consuming a food or drink item would require them to walk 5 miles to burn those calories off, as opposed to just seeing the calories, it had a direct impact on the choice.
When you were shown no label, the average calories ordered were 1,020. When you were shown calories only, which is a, you know, sort of the policy, the current policy, the average order was 927 calories. And when shown calories plus miles, the average order was 826 calories. So as you can see, there was a definite decrease in calories when you're shown calories plus miles.
The results of the initial study were so conclusive, they're now scaling up their research to test it in restaurants. Restaurant food labeling, showing a consumer how much exercise will be required to burn off the calories consumed, helping them comprehend the actual calorie value of the foods they choose, and maybe thus positively impacting their intention to consume fewer calories more wisely. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.